We have gathered five of the top competitors in the mid-stakes cash game world championship. In part one, they shared how they prepared and performed under pressure. In part two, they opened up about their struggles, setbacks, and what it took to get them there. Now, in part three, we focus on what actually moves the needle.
I think there's a misconception on how much variance there is in live poker cash games. I think people underestimate that so much.
I know. I understand the variance, and I know that it doesn't matter what you do in a day.
Good advice, because I feel like a lot of poker players really need that.
It really made my life more enjoyable.
Strategy, study habits, common leaks, and the breakthrough that took their game to the next level.
I have just been way too much of a calling station. I think it comes from projection.
And he's probably just playing the spot way better, because the EV difference between B50, B75 or whatever is just, you know, nothing, right?
And you need to be able to do at least 8 of a 10 in every spot to be a winner.
In my mind, there is no difference between a GTO play and the exploitative play, because...
Reflecting on how you got to this point strategically, what has been one of the biggest strategical breakthrough moments in your career, and what changed after that?
I guess, like, when I figure out that if you have a bluff catcher on the river and they underbluff by 1%, you can just fold your bluff catcher. I remember that as being like, wow, like, I haven't thought about it that way, and that kind of like made poker way more simple for me, because I feel like you go through this journey where in the beginning, where you're like complete recreational, poker is in some sense feels kind of simple. It's like you just, you know, you think he bluffs, you think he have it, like you just click fold, you click call, like you have this hand. And then you go through this phase where you're thinking about your range and like all these like things, you know, and like, oh, does he does this, does that, and do I have to defend, and do I have to call here 20% of time, blah, blah, blah. And then you go through this, like you go back to the thing where it just like, it becomes a little bit simple again.
I think my biggest poker insight is that in poker, you are free to do whatever you want. You can build a GTO strategy with any size. Some strategies are better or worse in terms of EV, but if you know how to gain that difference, and usually like with people, it's not like playing with machine who knows your strategy, you kind of gaining much more EV. And also I think not to be rigid in a certain, that you have to play like spots in a certain way. I enjoy like to be creative, and I can play the same spot differently on different days. Like, for example, like today I feel like I want to play polar strategies, I can play polar, or like I feel otherwise. Like you can do whatever as long as you have an idea how the mechanics of the game tree work, and what possible reactions you can face. But usually I'm not like, I don't rationalize them too much. I always been like a feel kind of player, so attuning to my intuition. Trying to attune to intuition more. In my mind, there is no difference between a GTO play and exploitative play, because exploit is a GTO with node locks, so it's kind of the same thing. You wouldn't want to play a GTO for the sake of playing like a nice looking strategy if you can quickly lock some assumptions in your brain. That would be the GTO to play.
Yeah, by far the biggest strategical breakthrough for me was when I started looking into population tendencies. I think that is also for me that was the biggest breakthrough, because I did study theory beforehand. I think if I had started by looking at population tendencies, the biggest breakthrough for me would have then been studying theory later on, because I really do feel like the aha moment was being able to kind of use both of those things to develop my own strategy. And to be honest, I feel like if somebody is like a very theoretical player or someone is very exploitative, I typically think they are not as well-rounded and they're kind of not as successful on average than the people that are aware of both of these things.
Why are they on itself standalone not enough? What's lacking?
I think that theory isn't enough because it's a defensive strategy, and it's just like, if you just play a defensive strategy, then you're going to be leaving money on the table in a lot of spots. And it's when you're already paying rake, it's difficult to really win a lot if you're just not going for interesting lines or like aggressive lines. I think in terms of population tendencies, it's not enough to just understand that, because you're going to make, I do think that you'll end up making like sizing mistakes where I think it's almost like purely exploitative. They just, like, they have tendencies that are really obvious and very bad. Like, they might just take a sizing that their bluffs want to take, or they might just take sizings that just their bluffs want to take. Maybe they end up in a spot where they don't know what the data says for this, and they don't know what the theory response is, and so they're just lost because they've never actually studied the spot. And so I think even if they do pick up EV in areas where, like, yeah, people are messing up here, if they're still going to have so many holes in their own game that it costs them a lot by not being aware of where they are. And so I think they kind of end up in a spot where, yes, they're winning in some spots, but they're losing in too many. And I actually think theory is the same thing, conversely.
From the questioner, it seemed like another big breakthrough, I guess we could call it a breakthrough, or maybe element of luck. You mentioned that you were pretty quickly surrounded by the right people who approach poker as a way to make money and not as a way to have fun. And you said that one of, you know, big mistakes that players make is they play for fun and not for money. Could you maybe elaborate on that? When did that mindset shift? And was that, you think, also a big sort of breakthrough or aha moment in the way you approach the game?
Yeah. So, like, first I'll just say what I mean by fun. I think that some people pursue poker and they kind of think of it in a way of like, oh, I want to play chess. I want to play this like I enjoy chess because it's about how good I can be compared to the other person. And the fun aspect is kind of like an indulgence of not even like caring really about how much money they make, just playing to try and feel like they're playing spots well. It's like, yes, this is like, I understand that aspect of it, definitely. But then I think it's entirely neglecting the entire purpose of being at the table, or at least in my opinion. Because if you did just like this, then go like, yeah, okay, you can play chess maybe. I guess poker's better because incomplete information, but still, I think the point remains that if you're just going to play and not care about winnings, it's kind of an immature way to approach the profession, because you're there to make money. It's not guaranteed how much you can make long term. Like, for example, I couldn't go to 100 and L today and get 100% rake back. It doesn't exist. And I'm glad that I maximized my hourly when it was there, because, you know, I was able to build a role to then play higher stakes and whatnot. And I think people pass up on these opportunities and just instead prioritize like playing Zoom because it feels fun and for no other reason than, oh, I get these interesting spots against regs, instead of prioritizing, okay, if I actually just play good spots and I play good volume, then I can still like have fun in these elements of the game, but I'm also able to move up in stakes and play against even better people who can put me in tougher spots if I enjoy that, but also get to make more money and actually get some financial security long term, which is not promised in poker.
Was the Cash Game World Championship for fun or for money?
For me, it was for fun. Like, for me, it was not for money, but I will say with the caveat that, like, I've passed what were my financial goals for myself, at least like in this year. And so I kind of allowed myself to just, you know, if I don't make any money, I don't really care at this point. So like, since I'm kind of taking a step back now from running as much as I was at the start of this year and definitely last year, I don't mind doing these things, but I mean, if I was trying to play like 2KNL for a living, I don't really think it would be a good decision necessarily to take a month and play 500NL against regulars and no fish.
I do get what you mean. I feel like I've heard both sides work, right? There's some people who really just love the game and they and with this competitiveness, and that's how they kind of rose to the top, and making good money was kind of a consequence of that. Obviously, you know, there should be some professionalism around it. I remember actually the first time I kind of heard kind of a similar approach to you was when we had Ben Abebeed on, where he said, no, I purely use poker. I enjoy poker in itself, but I use it to facilitate the things that I actually like to do in my life, right? It gives me the financial freedom to do other things. And that's more where he gets his satisfaction from. Whereas these other guys, they might just get all their satisfaction out of poker, right? And if you're trying to get that all out of poker because you have, I don't want to say necessarily nothing around that, but then I guess you have to kind of sprinkle in more fun because you get all your satisfaction out of your poker career. So I think you have to find the balance for yourself. I'm sure there can be some people listening now that might say, oh, if I only do it for that, I would never make it for this long, right? They need their view. So I think that it's quite personal. What's your thoughts here, Adam?
Yeah, I think it changes as you progress. I think often most of us get into poker just for the money, and that's a fine thing. It's a starting point of life. And then as you progress, maybe you achieve goals, and then you decide, do you want to keep pushing to achieve more and more stuff, or do you want to use it as a kind of a lifestyle aid to live the life you want, and also create opportunities, create amazing financial opportunities. You can become your own boss by being a poker player. And then as you evolve as a person and mature, you might go, actually, I see other things in my life which are maybe more important than poker or equally important, and I don't want to sacrifice those so I can do more poker, and I want to have it on the side. So yeah, it's definitely a very personal pursuit. I think most players will go through phases where poker is the only thing, and then maybe some more balance where it's like a partial thing or less intense. But yeah, I think it's just being flexible with what poker can provide. That's the beauty of it. Like, you're your own boss. You scale up your hours, your efforts, your dedication, or scale down based on what you want. And if you've created a good financial situation, you don't have that pressure, you're in a great situation, because now you can follow interests, follow passions, create a life that you really enjoy, and poker can still be a really, really good part of that.
But as you said, that you think most players get into poker because the money. For me personally, it wasn't necessarily like that. I just got into poker because I thought it was fun, and I kind of had to mature in a way that I had to take the money aspect more seriously. Luckily, I also had someone who definitely took that way more serious. I kind of had mixed people around me, right? Surprise, surprise, the guy that took the money aspect more serious, he's the richest of them all. So if that's the path you want to go, if that's very important to you, then obviously go down that path. So I had a little bit of mix in everything. I feel like throughout my career, I feel like I had a good mix of both, I'd say. So yeah, I find it very interesting. Anything you would like to add to that, Cherry, before we go on to the next topic? Or
yeah, I guess the other thing I'd add to it is just that I think that as I was moving up in stakes, I noticed there were some people like that I thought were very good poker players, let's say, and they had good win rates, but their preferred way of playing was just like four tabling rig tables for 3 hours a day and then calling it quits. And they're doing this at like 200NL or 100NL. And then by the end of the year, like, even if they had double my win rate, since they were playing such low volume, it's like they kind of run into this issue where they didn't have a bankroll to move up. They're still paying expenses. Yes, they had fun, but it's like, I feel like it really inhibits growth in poker. And I think, like, for every guy that's high stakes now because he just reg battled and crushed people, there's probably like 30 guys that are stuck in 100 Zoom or 100 Russian cash, whatever, that are still not able to, you know, move up in stakes.
So the biggest breakthrough strategically for me was playing on Ignition back in 2021, because it's an anonymous player pool. So, you know, no one has a screen name. And so what that means is that people can't counter exploit you, really. I mean, they can within that one session, but you come back the next day and they don't know who you are, compared to other sites where they can have a HUD or just remember your screen name or have hands on you, whatever. So on Ignition, I was able to play a super exploitative redline style where I was just sort of blasting all the spots that no one else in the pool was blasting, and people were folding. And if they had, if it weren't anonymous, they could counter adjust, but it's an anonymous pool. So it was very hard for people to counter adjust. So that's where I developed like my sort of redline style was Ignition.
You mentioned that during the challenge, you were mainly studying by sending hands to other guys who you consider to be better cash players. You mentioned guys, you know, that play up to like 2K, 3K, 5K on ACR cash. What is some insight? You mentioned you gain a lot of insights. Do you maybe have like an insight that stood out to you? Like, oh, that's actually very interesting and something that you took from that going forward in the challenge?
Yeah, one of my friends has always advocated for like one sizing flops and turns, which is something I've tried to incorporate more in my game over the last year or so. And I think it just makes your life simpler in a ton of ways. It's a much easier strategy to implement. And it's much harder for your opponents to read into your sizings, because when you're splitting sizings, you know, you're a human. So it's very, very difficult to keep both ranges properly balanced. And if you know your sizing for every spot and just use one sizing, it's going to be quite hard for people to get a sizing read.
I think being able to understand the statistics of my opponents, like I'm playing mostly against opponents and not my hand, is basically the thing that said to me, okay, yeah, wow. When I saw an stat that has this number, I know the strategy that I had to do to win against that, and it works, and it's like, wow.
How did that change? How did the experience of playing poker change? How did it feel different after you learned that? So I can imagine that before that you were mainly trying to play a strategy, and now you were kind of pointed in, hey, no, your opponent have certain tendencies and you can make exploits based on that. How did the experience of playing poker feel different after that?
Well, in order to make the exploitation, of course, you gotta know the theory. So when I knew that, I was more motivated to study theory so I can know how my opponents separate from that theory and what exploitative moves can I do. Because when I start doing this kind of stuff and my theoretical poker knowledge wasn't as high as I wanted, so I think it brings me a lot of motivation to analyze better what is the GTO strategy in most of the spots. So when I also can combine that with the data I have on this opponent, on the read that I have, because we are kind of all humans and it's really impossible to be able to copy what a server does. And all of the players, including myself, have tendencies. We will be more forced to do one thing on the other. And the EV0 spots are never EV0 in a real situation. They're going to be so EV positive or so EV minus because opponent will call more or call less or fall more or fall less in specific posts. Yeah, specific spot. So yeah, I think being able to combine those things has been really like the feeling that I had when I do that is really good. And this is something I have keep working on and will keep working on to be able to win against the best players.
Yeah, I think what it also really does, it really helps you keep an open mind, right? You always look for... you're willing to gather more information. I think actually a mistake that I often see is that players, when I analyze a game, like, oh yeah, I'm trying to figure out the strategy. I'm like, okay, well, let's pay attention to also the information that's available to you at the table. People kind of forget about that, right? Player reads, player tells, timing tells, bet size tells, read specific on the board, because they're so focused on, okay, what do I have to do here? They think about the strategy, they think about the theory, but they kind of miss valuable pieces of information that's right in front of you if you're willing to look for it. And I feel like kind of the consequence of your strategical breakthrough and seeing poker through that lens is it raised the necessity for you to pay attention and look, because you now understand the value that it has.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think there are a lot of ads and a lot of information that can be useful apart from knowing what the server does in 10.5 dual rainbow. Like, also, you mentioned timing tails. Well, this is something I've been studying a lot in the last couple of months, and sometimes it's really helpful. Like, I've seen a lot of players that I play against making the same timing tails with, different timing tails with Valion Bluffs. These EV0 situations, you can change the way you react to them based on that, for example. So, yeah.
Yeah, this was definitely something actually I was paying a lot of attention to in the challenge as well, right? Because you have the showdowns. And there were some interesting reads also in terms of certain player profiles. It's quite interesting. Obviously not going to give the whole information out there here. But if you're willing, it's again, like if you're willing to look, right, you will find. But people often forget to look. I think that's a big problem in poker nowadays. Are you grinding hard, studying solvers, reviewing hands, but still not getting those results that you know you're capable of? You're putting in the time and effort, but without clear direction, that effort does not pay off. That is why I created the Mechanics Leak Buster program, which is the exact system I use to make over 7 figures playing online poker and have since taught to hundreds of students so they could do the same. Through our leak finder stats and pop-ups, you will gain clarity on your biggest leaks and tendencies, insights on how your strategies have been performing in-game, and the impact variance has had on your results. But knowing your stats is only the beginning. In the program, we dig deep into the root causes behind your leaks and tendencies and use a proven 7-step system to fix them for good and gain the skills to improve and continuously evolve as a poker player. You'll study more effectively, overcome leaks and tendencies that felt impossible to break, and rebuild trust and confidence in your game, finally seeing your hard work pay off as you move up the stakes. So if you're ready to stop guessing and start improving with clarity, break through the patterns that have been holding you back and take your game to the next level, join the Mechanics Leakbuster program using the link down below. And for the first month of enrollment only, you will get access to weekly group coaching calls with me and get a chance to win a one-on-one coaching session in which I personally review your game. So don't miss out on this limited opportunity. Join the Mechanics Leakbuster program using the link down below, and looking forward to seeing you guys in there. What is the best advice you have been given, and what impact did this have on your life or your career?
I actually listened to your podcast with MMA Shadok. He really made me think about now, how I should sort of like spend my money and not letting a lot of money just be on the side, and sort of trying to sort of like think more what I do with the money outside of poker. Like, I already have some sort of plan, but like right now I definitely have way too much money on like some sites, and just sort of try to think about what I will do with these money to create more wealth. That was like actually like a very good advice, because I feel like a lot of poker players really need that, trying to be more professional with my money.
Yeah, for me as well. So I definitely enjoyed it. I remember actually we did a episode with, I think, Peter Arts. Is that his name? Yeah, the Belgian NFT player. And he said the same, like, don't leave your money uninvested. A lot of players, you know, you can just always put you don't have to keep your whole role in poker. I remember also, I don't know if you listened to the episode we did with Mario Mosbach. He said something really interesting about the consideration if he wants to play high stakes online. And he was mentioning like, okay, let's say I do play higher stakes online, then I need suddenly like, I don't know, 8x the bankroll. But this money that I now need to put extra, I could have also just invested somewhere, get, let's say, 6 to 8% return of investment quite easily guaranteed, compared to putting that into poker, added variance, and then basically he was thinking about it more that way. Like, oh, do I need 8x to roll? Do I get 8x the amount of return of investment? Probably not. That was actually pretty eye-opening for me. I was like, huh, actually that makes a lot of sense. You need so much more money if you want to play high stakes, and that money, you have to also take into consideration what other things you could do with the money, right? And how much ROI actually increases on your year.
Also, just like he talked about this, like, there's not one formula for one player. Like, there's so many different formulas, and just like figuring out like what sort of what works out best for you, and like thinking about that. I feel like that's very important for a poker player.
Yeah, I don't know. The thing came to mind to start jiu-jitsu. It really made my life more enjoyable, because as a poker player, and especially I've been kind of a lonely one, and I moved a lot through different places. So it always happened the same story, like in 1 year you develop relationships with people, then you move to the other place and you repeat, and it was kind of, But when I started to train, jiu-jitsu has a strong sense of a community, and at some point I developed a lot of friendships at the gym, and later on I realized that whenever I leave, I will make friends just through this. That was a significant change for me.
My dad always says, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And so for me, that's sort of what I try to do in poker. Show up every day and, you know, take your one bite and hope by the end you've achieved what you want to achieve.
I think I would say phrase that my grandfather told me when I was young, and it's something that he also taught to my mother, which is be able to enjoy 100% when you have time for enjoy, but also remember when you're working to give 100%, because if you want to enjoy 100%, you need to do the previous work. Having this kind of mentality of be able to give everything on two different scenarios, which are work and joy, is the correct equilibrium of your life.
How do you apply this in your day-to-day life? Do you maybe have an example?
To be honest, I think I don't apply the joy thing as good as the work thing. But I told you before, when I play poker, when I do something, I just want to be the best one at what I do and try to not do too many things at the same time, but the things I do, try to make them correct and to take it really seriously. However, for example, I think I have to improve the side of also forgetting about work in your life and connect with people you like, people you love, your family, whatever. Which is something that from the probably last year, I haven't done it a lot because I'm so focused on poker right now. But probably it's the same mistake that I told you in the challenge, that I didn't rest, but I kind of improved in that. And for example, the last 5 months that I've lived in Estonia, in Tallinn, I've been playing almost, not every day, but yeah, almost every day. And now I'm going on a 1 month vacation. And probably in November, I will go also 3 weeks with one friend to Philippines. And I hope I will be able to disconnect 100% from poker, or 75%, to be able to enjoy the award that I won by working that much. How can I say that?
On the contrary, what is the worst advice you've ever received, or that you think is commonly given in the poker space?
If I had more time to think about it, I would probably at some point like come up with like a very bad one. But there's nothing like that comes up on top of my head. I remember a conversation with a guy once that was like thinking that he thought that everyone was just approaching it wrong. He was just like, you just like try and get to, I don't know, 2 million at like the fastest possible. So you just take insane variance, and then if you drop down, now you just start grinding again. But I just feel like this is such a, like, you need such little variance to go against you for that to happen. And now you have to start over and go and and thinking that when you go down and you can say you can just grind it up again, sometimes you also go down and you can just like take on bad barriers and it can take you a long time to grind it up again. So it's like, I feel like that approach was very bad, to just go insane with your role, and probably not the thing for 99% of all players. I feel like that was a pretty bad advice.
Yeah, I feel like then they usually talk about like the compounded upside effect, right? That if you can make that shot work, it's there's a lot of value in that. I do indeed, like on paper, if you just look at the rational numbers, and if you have a guy who's just doing the math, like, oh yeah, this is the best approach, but then you don't take in consideration the whole mental thing around it, you know, how will you bounce back after a shot failing. And this is also very, very personal. Like, I know guys that are just super rational. Oh yeah, what do you mean? Yeah, you just take a shot. Oh, it doesn't work, no problem. You know, and for other guys, it has a bigger effect than just, oh yeah, I lost my shot. You know, so I feel like you have to definitely take how you work in consideration there. It's not, there's not one approach fits all.
Yeah. I mean, I only take big variants when I go play these live stops, because I only do it like 3-4 times a year. So I know when I'm like, when I'm on playing online, I'm not taking crazy variants at all. I'm doing very safe. And then when I go to EPTs or whatever, then I take on more variants, because I know this is only happening like a couple of times a year, and I will have, you know, high regenerative investments when I play. That's sort of like how I do it.
One time my friends told me to buy this coin called Blender that like went to zero. I didn't put that much money in it, but yeah, that's the worst financial advice, at least.
I don't think I have received too many worse advices, but I think I will say that there are a lot of people that just look at the solver and just they think, okay, if the solver says that, it's okay. You just didn't play like the solver, you're playing bad. And there are too many guys that have this kind of approach where if they see you made a bad play, they will say, okay, it's a mistake. And having this open mind you were talking about before maybe will help you thinking, maybe it's not a mistake. Maybe he's doing that because he's thinking that you might be doing this other thing. So I think, yeah, there are some people that are not open mind, the opposite of open mind. And now I don't find it, but I think it will be the worst you can say to a poker player, like to not being able to think outside the box.
Was there a mistake you made for way too long? One that was maybe hard to admit or hard to fix?
Yeah, definitely. So like a big mistake that I would say I was making for a long time was I'd be playing my session and then I'd just have like a podcast open on the side. And just be like, kind of like splitting my brain between focusing on the podcast and playing. It's hard to really say how much that cost me in terms of like how much longer it took for me to get better skill-wise, or how much it took off my win rate. But I definitely think this type of splitting your focus or just playing a video in the background, I think is really costly. I'm not sure how many players actually do this. I know it's a big issue for me, but now I will listen to music when I play, but I will try and stay focused when I am actually playing.
In strategic terms, the first thing comes to mind is that the hugest mistake was to play in a lot of tables, because it hinders your progress a lot. I think the best way to approach the game is to play for 6 tables and think through every decision and build more reads on people, trying to spot timings, things they do. It's a more enjoyable way to play the game, I think, as well. It was kind of what I was doing for the last years. Just get really boring to do it at mid-stakes.
Definitely. I have just been way too much of a calling station. I think it comes from projection. Like if you bluff a lot, maybe you assume other people are also bluffing a lot. So you're projecting your thoughts into them. So yeah, I've always struggled with calling down too many spots that aren't bluffed properly.
How do you fix that?
Put my mouse on the fold button. whatever I can. I mean, I think it comes down to just respecting people a little less, you know, not giving someone credit for finding like all the super creative bluffs in certain spots, and, you know, just saying, all right, you have it, you win, I fold.
You feel like you progressed? You're happy with where you are now, or you think you could still... Is it like something that still, if you slip a bit to C, B game, you know the tendency?
Yeah, it's definitely still a leak. I've patched it some, because in the beginning it was very bad, but I've improved it some, still working on it, but yeah, it's something I always have to keep in mind.
Probably looking at the results or the graphs that much time, like I was going to bed probably thinking I lost this amount of money or I won this amount of money. And sometimes I was telling my friend, no, I don't see the graph. And maybe I was looking at the graphs, like I was lying to myself. So I think this is the mistake that probably I did in the past, because right now I feel completely different from that thinking. Like, I know, I understand the variance, and I know that it doesn't matter what you do in a day. You can get the results that are going to be, and it doesn't depend on you. So being able to understand what depends on you and what doesn't depend, and be able to go to bed without having this thought of, okay, I want to know how I did it, is something that I have improved, and I did some mistakes in the past. I had this necessity of knowing if I did good or well. Where now I think, okay, I play good. That's okay.
How has your approach to improving as a poker player and studying the game evolved? And how did it become more efficient over time?
Some people have a lot of different approaches to this. I feel like that's a lot of people. They sort of go like, now I'm going to starting button against big blind. And then other people is going to be like, I'm going to look at the spots that comes up, and then I'm going to like look into the spot stats. I think find interesting. And I feel like I'm in the last camp where I do kind of, I do both, but I feel like I'm in the last camp because I find it more interesting. But as we spoke about in this challenge, there was a lot of spots where I was like, how do I want to create my strategy in this spot? Like, and I'm kind of like in doubt, can I do this strategy? And like, is it a pun to do this strategy? And just like figure out like how, like structure your strategy in a sense, right? Make it simple. And yeah.
Yeah, I think when I started, it was a lot more difficult because I wasn't aware of any tools where you could like look at your frequencies, your stats, compare it to what solver's stats would be in similar spots. And so it was a lot tougher to actually like identify maybe frequency leaks that I had in areas. So that was like a large time consuming thing for me, where I actually had to manually try and find this myself. Now it's a lot easier. Like in Hantenote, you can just find these things and then see, oh, I'm over falling river here. And then you can still decide, like, is that good or bad? Like, you can look into that and find an answer as well. Before, that was a lot more challenging. And so my approach would actually just be to, I mean, my approach was literally just to keep trying, keep playing, keep looking for new things, trying things. And by chance, when I did find something that fixed my problem, then it helped. But it was a lot less efficient back then because I couldn't just in a structured way look at it objectively. Like, this is where I'm leaking, this is what I need to fix. Which is what I think is just the easiest way to... The easiest way to fix leaks now is definitely just like a stat checker, I would say.
The biggest breakthrough for me was when I got introduced to a community of better players. Initially, when I started playing poker, I was sort of on my own. I had maybe one other friend in college who wasn't that serious. But as I progressed, I kept meeting more and more very good players, very smart players who were much better than me and could sort of take me under their wing. And I was very curious about the game, so maybe I was able to offer a little bit to them in terms of figuring out some things they hadn't thought of. So yeah, finding beneficial relationships like that has been great. And then a lot of them, you know, you become great friends with outside of poker. So a ton of benefits to that.
For the last 2 years, I've been studying a lot of theory because, well, I haven't studied before I become a professional poker player, almost any theory. I watch some videos, but and sometimes receive some classes and some lessons, but not something that I put effort on, that I write on. So for the last 2 years, I've been studying almost every sport in the game and also do some worksheet where I summarize all the principal points and I add more information on those worksheet if I find something different today that I didn't have in the past. Now I put that in my work document so I can have all the information clear and summarized. But I would say that since last year, since I've been playing higher stakes and the players are better, I am more focusing on being, I would say, more balanced or playing more GTO because these guys are quite better and they also play more solver-oriented. However, in the past, I was playing, yeah, you can be completely unbalanced in every spot in 500 NL because it doesn't matter. No one is going to know most of the time. And now, because I face really great players, I need to take care more about not only how I perceive my opponents, but also how my opponents perceive me and how they might adapt to me because they know how to adapt. And I don't want to show them all my strategy, at least that is so easy to read. If I have Size Intel, for example, or whatever, I had to take theory more seriously.
Yeah, and I feel like also once you go up in stakes, the pool gets smaller and people naturally will pay more attention to you because they face the same players more often. So from that perspective as well, like you said, I feel like if you have leaks in your game, they will get exploited more easily, or you have unbalances, people will pick on them because, yeah, they simply pay more attention to you because they face you more often, right? Because they're simply less stable, yeah. Less opposition.
It became much more efficient when GTO Viz became a thing and when they added an odd lock tool, because now you can even, like the lazy person as I am, can do put into some assumptions and play with them like in a matter of minutes. Before that, it was kind of a process to do. That definitely helps with efficiency, but not only for myself. So it makes it a competition.
If you're looking to level up your poker game, let me tell you about GTO Wizard. It's got everything you need in order to improve as a poker player, whether you're just starting out or already crushing it. You got tools like a hand history analyzer, a GTO trainer, and even custom drills to help you sharpen up your skills and make smarter plays. It's what so many of the guests we have had on are using in order to dominate cash games and tournaments. Get started for free and get 10% off your first purchase using the link down below, gtowizard.com/mechanics. If you sign up, you also get access to the weekly coaching webinars where you can learn from me and other great coaches. So looking forward on educating you guys over there. How do you identify, prioritize, and fix leaks in your game? And could you maybe walk us through maybe a recent example?
Yeah, I remember last year I asked for an expert, well, someone that was quite better than me, to look into all my data. I sent him all my database, my statistics, in the also Poker Academy that I am working with. You can upload your statistics and they will have one by one meeting with you where they will go number by number. Okay, this is the theoretical number, this is your number, and this is what maybe you should do to your meta. If I want to give you an example, I mean, it's an easy one, but for example, one of my leaks last year, it was that I wasn't forbearing enough in most of the positions. And I made a lot of changes, not only in the frequencies, but also the different morphology I can have towards different people. And now that I know that, I have improved that also, because against polarized ranges or linear ranges, I have different morphology. So this is something that not only I have improved, but I have to keep improving, because maybe if I start forwarding more, some opponents will three-bet less to me. So I got to be really careful on how I do my changes right now, because I think people are being able to adapt to you really fast. If you want, for example, a specific example of how can I... Well, it's not something that I did bad, but for example, a few weeks ago, I was playing heads up with a really nice rec who was folding too much to a small 3-bet. I look about it on the solver and he has to call so many hands that he wasn't calling. But then 1 week after that, I saw some hands that he was calling that, okay, now I realize he just adapted to me and he's doing great. So that leak that he had, he just improved it. It's not something that I did, but he did it. And I realized, okay, now I cannot exploit that. So I think that being said, is something that I did in the past with my previous leaks. I have to keep doing it.
I have no leaks. I'm a perfect player. I guess what's just really important is that you play some hands, and some of the hands you play, they might work out, but that doesn't mean it's a good place. So I think it's important to try and be as objective as possible, and don't think that just because you made this very crazy play that it's a good play, and sort of try to still studying it and sort of be very honest with the solver's response and with what a human does, because it's very easy to just be like, I just made this because my opponent is doing that and I know he's doing that, but it doesn't mean that he's doing that. Like, even though you think he's doing something else, it doesn't even mean that it's like that good, right? And if you're wrong about it, you might be bleeding, right?
How do you do that? Like, yep. Not essentially not lie to yourself.
It's very hard. You sort of have to. I mean, I have a guy, where if I send him a hand, he's almost never like, I will send him like the interesting ones, right? I won't be sending him like, should I arrange bet here? Like, I'll be sending like the interesting ones. And almost every time I send him a hand, he will be highly critiquing my play, right? So he will almost be like, so that's kind of like a nice reality check, because I mean, first of all, he's a better player than me, but also it's like a guy that just have a completely different view of the hand, and that can just make you sort of, that makes me like sort of like question what I did and sort of think about, okay, maybe I shouldn't be as confident as I am right now, because of that could just be easy variance, right? Like, I can just be having this thought that I think he does this and then he did that, but that could just be variance, you know? Maybe he's like not doing it all the time at all. Like, maybe he's just, yeah, if that makes sense.
What does your current study routine look like?
Well, currently I'm at the beach on vacation, but when I'm really locked in and on poker, usually I like to study with one or at most two other people, and a variety of different formats. Maybe we do a hand review, a deep run review. Maybe we just focus on one certain spot. Maybe we, you know, dive deep on a specific exploit, look at final table replays, see what the top players are doing. It takes on a ton of different formats, but it's sort of it's always been spontaneous for me, not really super regimented for the most part. There have been some stretches where I plan out, you know, 3 weeks and I'm going to hit, you know, these 10 spots each for a certain amount of time, but for the most part, it's been more free-flowing.
Is it then more like you've identified the spot that you're uncertain about and you kind of use that, or maybe like your curiosity as like a compass to steer you in the direction of what you want to focus on?
Right. For example, I mean, maybe I see in a sim that blind v blind and limp check on a mono flop the big blind should check back a flush half the time. And I ask all my friends, you know, how often do you think people check back a flush here? And everyone's like, oh, like never, like 5%, maybe 10% at most. So then you run the node lock for what you think people are doing and get the solution for how to play against that.
And then press the button and be aggro.
Yeah.
What's something that, in your opinion, players spend too much or too little time on?
I'm pretty sure that a lot of guys are very focused on being like, oh, this is like a B75 spot. So like he bet B50. I'm like, he's definitely making a mistake. Like there's no way, like this is just wrong. Where like if the guy just studied in the spot and with B50 and has the frequencies with B50 more correct than you have, then he's probably just playing the spot way better because the EV difference between B50, B75 or whatever is just, you know, nothing, right? So it's like thinking more about that. And less about like trying to find the correct sizing in the spot, if that makes sense.
I don't think there are many people who study more than they should. So I'm definitely guilty of that. Because it's like playing is the most enjoyable, for most people, it's the most enjoyable part in poker. But you have to put in hours into understanding the game and kind of slowly analyzing all the things, like going deep into the game tree. And also, I'm still guilty of that. I have kind of a good surface level understanding of a lot of different strategies. But I think what most players lack, especially at mid-stakes, is a deep understanding of them. It's kind of taking each board and analyzing each turn, river, and doing it with node locks. It takes a lot of time, but the more you do it, the more patterns you have and the deeper understanding you have. And I think that's what I would do if I want to play higher. Because it's easy to get things on the surface level, especially when you have so much educational content. I always watch courses, videos, but it's a lazy way to study. You kind of watching someone doing the work, but the most benefits comes when you do the work yourself. You can use educational materials for inspiration and stuff and ideas, but you need to go deep into game tree yourself if you want to achieve some sort of excellence.
I think blockers are super overrated in most spots, like river bluffing or bluff catching spots. Like if someone bets pot on the river, you need to win a third of the time. And in many cases, it's going to be you only win 20% of the time. So block, unless it's a super narrow range spot, blockers aren't going to swing the equation 13%, or you win 50% of the time against pot. So then you just call your whole range. So like, I think a lot of spots you face should be range calls or range folds, you know, or range bluffs or range give ups, regardless of blockers. So I think like, you know, when you're facing a pot-sized river bet from a guy who never bluffs, you don't want to think, oh, I'm unblocking bluffs. The bluffs don't exist. So just fold.
Yeah, so what should people consider instead?
People should consider who they're playing against more. I think every hand you play is sort of like a game of... It should be almost like you're playing a game of heads-up against your opponent, and all your thoughts are focused on them and their tendencies. And then if they're a very elite player or you're unsure, then you can go down your list to blockers or, you know, more micro strategy things like that. But that's only once, you know, you've looked at the big picture first and the global frequency.
Yeah, I very strongly agree with this because a lot of mistakes that people make is because they go down the wrong thought process. And if you just start all your thought process with, who am I playing against in the hand? Because every player deserves a different type of thought process, or the things that you take in consideration is different, right? If I play against Connor, I might take other things in consideration than if I play against some recreational, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Two extreme examples. So yeah, I strongly agree. It's very good advice, people. Pay attention.
Working on your game, your skills, your maximize your skills, maximize your value. Like being able to play good your value hands is one of the best things in poker, because bluff catchers and bluffs most of the time are EV0 in any particular spots. But being able to win the most of your value hands probably is something you need to spend a lot of time on. And if that is not one of your strengths, you need to take a look on it. And also being able to understand what are your weaknesses and how the meta is doing against that is something you also need to take action on, because there are really different kind of meta if you're playing in different size. And well, if you have access to data, you have can do a meta analysis, for example, based on the data you have, you can also take like a deeper kind of analysis on your game. Not only your game, but also how the meta works.
What in your opinion is the best thing a player can do to increase his EV?
I would say trying to keep things simple. Trying to simplify spots where if you look up a spot and you see like, oh, here we c-bet 70% of the time and we take 30%, you can be like, fine, let's just range bet the spot and let's try to focus on playing the turn better, or like our response to the check raises, and like sort of going like that in sort of like complicate things for yourself even more, because it can be very complicated and you can save some time. I think that can help you a lot. And maybe also, I mean, kind of like if you have a bluff catcher spot, follow intuition and then look up the spot and be like, okay, this spot, I am losing X amount of BB 100 by calling. Okay, I can't get that out of line. Like I have to sort of like try and, unless you're just like super correct, but like you sort of like try to don't go too crazy the either way or the other way, and sort of like keep yourself in check with that. Like keep like screenshotting these spots and like looking them up to see, you know, how far off are we, even though we, yeah, instead of just trying to like remember what a solver might want to call.
Well, I think it, like this best specific thing, I think depends a lot on whatever that player's leaks are, but I guess more generally would be to speak with better players on a very regular basis. Make sure you're having detailed feedback from better players on your hands. Maybe even get a database review if you play online. If you're playing higher stakes live, definitely look into getting a coach. But for me, I've always gained more poker-wise through human interactions compared to just watching a video on my own or looking at a solver on my own, because you can hear a completely new perspective that you might not even be able to generate or think of on your own.
What is the biggest misconception or flawed belief players have about poker or being a poker professional?
I think there's a misconception on how much variance there is in live poker cash games. I think people underestimate that so much. Like people just open up a poker variance calculator and they'll just input like 20 BB per 100 win rate, the standard deviation, and I'll say, oh, it's no variance, you just win every session. And I actually, like, my experience playing, I don't think that's how it works at all, because you can just be in a 1200 BB pot and then lose the pot, and then it's like it's really difficult to get that win rate back unless you have a similar spot, and it might just not come about for another month. So I feel like people definitely underestimate the variance that comes with playing live poker, especially if you're playing deep stacked. And even if you're not, like if you're playing in a private game that runs high, it's like, okay, you play this game and then the game can just like break, the recreational stops playing, suddenly the only other game you have access to is like five times lower in stakes, and so whatever you won or lost at the highest stake, you actually cannot recover because the game just doesn't exist anymore.
maybe people are too optimistic about how easy it is, or how much money you can make, or yeah, how easy it is, I would say, because for me, the poker world is very hard to get to the top of and requires a lot of skill, a lot of luck, a lot of work. And there are much easier things to do out there. So I would say you have to make sure you really, really love the game to dedicate yourself to it, because you're not, unless you're a tournament player and just bink the main or something, you're not really just going to walk into success in poker.
If you want to focus more while playing, let me tell you guys about Brain FM. This is actually something I stumbled on prior to the World Championship, and it's been what I've been listening to for hours and hours straight while playing. It's music specifically designed to help you focus. Personally, I have ADHD. They have a special function where they play sound that interacts very well with your brainwaves, helping you to focus. And it's been something that I've been listening to and using for doing work or playing poker, and it has definitely changed my focus and helped my game. So I wanted to inform you guys on this opportunity. Link down below, 1 free month trial, and yeah, let me know how you like it.
Actually, a guy like a Rick Nimrod, he sent me a YouTube video of some, it's called like 3 p.m. study with me, where it's like rain sounds and thing, and he said he got it from you. I've been doing it a lot ever since, and it has helped a lot for me as well. It really can get you in the zone, and also this thing, yeah, like I put it on and I just know for the next 3 hours I'm locked in, like I know now, and that's like 3 hours is kind of like a nice time, you know, where you just know like now it's time to go.
I want
to
do a little mini rapid fire with you. Simplify your strategy or embrace complexity? And why?
Embrace complexity. It's just, I think it's more enjoyable way to play.
I guess I would say simplify. Simplify in the beginning, and then on the river, try to make things a little bit more complex, and try to, on the river, be more creative. Explore that area, because there's more to be gained compared to on slop.
Yeah, I just say simplify. If you can make your strategy more complex, I think it's more easy to fuck it up than it is to actually gain EV, and also simplifying just makes it easier to play more tables as well.
Simplify your strategy, because if you know what you're playing and you're confident in it, then in game you'll be able to execute it without any hesitation.
When you mentioned simplify your strategy, I saw something that needs some elaboration. In the questionnaire, you mentioned that one of your strengths was your fearlessness and use of unique lines. I like going off the tree a lot to see who can play street poker better. How does street poker and simplify go hand in hand?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wanted to say complex in that answer, but it, for me, like flops and turns, I always one size. So for me, the complexity comes like mainly on rivers, because that the river's the node where you should be able to range your opponent the tightest. And that's when you can deviate the most. So yeah, I like keeping things simple, flop and turn, and then river, it's time to freestyle.
Is that partly also to have a good idea of how your opponent's range look on the river? Whereas if you would mix it up a lot, maybe already on the flop and on the turn, you might also have a less of a good idea about his range.
If you start using, you know, too crazy of sizes on flop and turn, maybe you don't have enough experience in game to help people react to that size. And yeah, also, you know, I've just put in the most study using, you know, common sizes on flop and turn. So those are the ones I try to implement.
And when you say, to clarify, when you say one size, you don't mean that you only use one size, but when you see the texture, you decide on one dominant size that you're going to use for that texture, correct?
Right. So like I'd say, okay, this flop, my strategy is half pot or check, or my strategy is quarter pot or check, or pot or check.
How do you also feel like, because what is simple kind of evolves with your skill as a poker player, what simplification looked for you 4 years ago might be different now. So how do we define simple?
Yeah, I think simple should just be whatever you can predictably execute in game, whatever you can trust yourself to remember and implement in game. So if you're some super memory genius and can foresize every flop, you know, go ahead and do that. If you know you can't, then maybe stick with one or at most two.
Simplify strategy, because poker is too complex in my opinion. By saying simplify strategy, it doesn't mean you don't have to look at the table. Like, okay, I would say simplify strategy, but first take a look at your opponent, because okay, you might have this simplified strategy that works, but then against opponent, you can do whatever you like and you can have a different kind of approach. But I think simplifying the strategies in today's metagame are working really good, because poker is so complex and you need to be able to do at least 8 of a 10 in every spot to be a winner. You don't have to, in your opinion, at least the stakes that I play, to be a 10 in any spots. So my goal is to be improving in any spots point by point. If when I started my poker career, I was a deuce. Last year, maybe I was a 5, and now I was a 7. My goal is next year to be a 9 or 8.5 in every spot. And by simplifying most of my strategies, I can get that easily. If I sometimes get too complex about it, it's going to be harder. However, of course, if you are improving, your strategies are going to be more complex.
Yeah, and also like it's like what you said, right? As you get more advanced yourself, your definition of what's simple also changes. So, and a very important point here, that simplifying your strategy is just the start. From there, now you don't have to think about that anymore. You can think about, like you said, what's my opponent doing? What's the information? So you can add layers of, let's call it complexity or adjustments, because you don't have to think about the quote-unquote basic stuff anymore, right? So it's I feel like actually a big mistake people make is that they work only on their simplified kind of baseline strategy and they think, okay, now I'm just going to execute that and that's it, right? But it's what that enables you to do from there that where the value is in a simplified strategy, in my opinion.
Yeah. Let's take, for example, a small blind against big blind. Single day spot is probably the most difficult spot in poker, 6 months talking. You can have a lot of sizes there in most of the boards if you are a small blind. If you simplify that to one size, which is a simplified strategy, it will be so easy for you at least to play this spot, as I said, from a 7 out of 10. If you just make it more complex and you have four sizing for each board, maybe it's going to be harder for you and you are going to make more mistakes. So something more simple doesn't mean it's worse. That was my point.
Follow the data or trust your intuition?
I wanted to say intuition. Like, intuition is based on data. In an environment where you have to make fast decisions, there is so much data flowing around. Sometimes you can subconsciously just feel the other guy weak or strong, and you don't completely realize why, but it might be.
If your intuition is good, then trust your intuition. If not, I'd say follow the data.
Nah, intuition, for sure. Why? Because data sometimes have out of variance and data changes. Like, if you see my data this year, it's completely different from my last year. So I think your intuition and also the game flow mind, the mindset that you have on this opponent, if you think he's acting by emotions, if you think he's kind of tilted, if you think he will be more tempted to passiveness in this kind of spot, is something that I think is really, really important, and I will trust that more than a data.
How do you distinguish between if your intuition is showing something that's indeed correct, or when your intuition is biased towards maybe, you know, something that you would like to do? Let's say you're naturally more of a station or naturally more of a folder. How do you differentiate intuition versus bias?
I think it's really hard to differentiate. I think you will need out of showdowns to know if you are right or wrong. But sometimes you can be just running good. They have the bluffs that the only bluffs that they have in this spot, and you're calling and they are showing the bluff and you might be making an even minus call. I think it's really hard to know, René. Really, really hard. You can check that with, for example, different poker minds. Like, I always like to share my thoughts with other players, and therefore there you can have some other opinions, and they can say to you, okay, I agree on that. And if they are really good poker players, you might think, okay, if they agree on that, then I think that too. Maybe that's not bias, and that's with intuition.
RNG, yes or no, when and why?
Well, sometimes yes, when you don't see a clear answer and you have an indifferent decision. For example, when I played a lot of tables, sometimes I just didn't have time to make a good decision, and the spot felt like it's whatever, so you can RNG. But for most of the time, usually you can make a strong decision, like in definitive one.
RNG, yes, for sure. Because if you don't, I mean, I can speak for myself only, I will start doing either one way or another. And if I play against a guy that I know is not using an RNG, I see that I will be having an easier time figuring the guy out. Obviously, you shouldn't just like RNGing like any spot possible, because that's just going to be, you're going to be ending up in so many scenarios with so many different kind of hands that can go one way or the other. And if you don't control yourself, I think you will end up being crushed, unless you're just like crazy good. But I'm not that good. So yeah, for me, for sure, RNG.
Personally, I actually really like using RNG myself. It depends on, it honestly depends on your approach. I feel like it's hard to really give a right or wrong answer. There's that, the times where I say don't use it is like as a cop-out, where you actually don't know what to do. So it's like, I'll flip a coin. I think it's better to try and work for an answer yourself in most spots, and then go from there. Like, for example, okay, if I'm on a river spot and I think, okay, this call is probably just like, I could fold it, I could call it. I think first it's worth thinking, is this actually just a winning call in practice or not? Is this a losing call in practice? And then if you're kind of, like, if I'm like, okay, it's probably, they're probably playing pretty accurate in this spot, then yeah, okay, RNG is fine. If not, I think it's fine to actually just like play pure in some of these spots one way or the other with certain hands. And then there are other spots as well, like pre-flop, it's not, I don't really think it's necessary, but I guess you can if you want to. Flops and turns seems fine to me as well to RNG.
So I use RNG pre-flop and MTTs because there are spots where I feel like it's necessary. Like if you're three betting from the big blind and you have all these combos that mix three bets, if you just do them always, you're three betting too much. If you do them never, you're not three betting enough. And then if you simplify by only picking certain hands, then you have problems post flop. So I like using it for pre-flop, sometimes for flops. That way, you know, you'll have some flush draws you check call, some you check raise. But then turns and rivers, I almost never RNG, because I feel like once you've gotten to turn, you're generally off in human land, and hands aren't going to be indifferent between things anymore. There should be a clear decision, or you should at least have an opinion of what the best play is by the turn or river.
Final one, will we see you in the high stakes edition of the Cash Game World Championship, and what would you still need to work on to have a real shot at crushing it over there?
Hopefully one day. Of course, this year is going to be no answer, but my poker career has just started, so I will love to compete again the best in the world in the near future. Hopefully it's going to be in a few years, but if it's in 5 or 6 or whatever years, I will be so happy that I did it. And in order to get that, not only my bankroll has to increase a lot, but also I need to still be able to improve a lot of things in my game, but also in my mental game, in order to be able to compete with these beasts that are playing the high stakes challenge. So I think in the following years, I will just try to become a better person, better player. And by doing that every day, I think my chances of participating in that challenge will improve.
I don't think you will see me at the high stakes competition. It's just not realistic to close that gap in skill level in a year, I think. Maybe it is, but just to predict, probably not.
I don't think so. I mean, I think I would have to get coached. And also state. I'm not going to be playing in Helsinki. I'm not in contact with anyone about that. So I guess my answer is going to be no. I would be open for it, but it's not like I am the most hungry guy in the world to just like having to play the high stakes giants, if that makes sense. I'm going to UBT Plaza and I would be playing like the 10K. That's going to be like my highest buy-in and play the 5K main and stuff like that. But that's obviously very different from playing this 10K challenge. That's something different.
I don't plan on it, but it's possible I take a shot at it. But what would I have to work on? That's a good question, actually. I'm not entirely sure. If it's going to be anti and non-anti, then I think that it's probably going to be harder to just wing it in the anti format against like the best regs than it is at mid-stake. So I would probably say the anti stuff I shouldn't slack on, and then also the multi-way stuff I could probably use looking into a bit more.
I don't think I would grind that consistently just yet. Maybe jump in a little bit, but yeah, I would have a lot of work to do on my game before I'd feel like I'd be competitive there. Like I said, over the last few years, I haven't put that much study into cash, and these are the very best cash players in the world, so I think it would be a little bit arrogant of me even to jump into that game and expect to be winning without a ton of work on my end.
Coming up in the next episode.
I'm so offended. You just talked for 5 minutes about his hand, and you didn't mention a single theory thing. What is going on? And just starting trashing me.
I think it's a spot where people are going to go too much into the blockers thing.
Not really repping much at all on my end, but if you think they only have a bluff, then I think you can just go ahead and put it on.
I won all my money in Zant Gigs.
Okay, nice.
This one is really funny.